You're listening to a sermon by John Hodges, recorded on Sunday, August 5th, 2018, at the Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only, and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Thank you for the invitation, Evan, and to you all. I'm here really because my wife is sister to Abe Friesen, and that identifies me as a non-Mennonite who has been welcomed into this very extensive family of Mennonites and find I have hundreds, if not thousands, of brothers and sisters. So thank you for your welcome. This question of what is man, raised by the psalmist and repeated in Hebrews, I think it can be addressed in two ways. We can ask, what is man, the species, Homo sapiens, which provides quite a lot of information about us because of modern research, particularly associated with genetics. But we may also ask, what is man as a person? And it's particularly the second aspect that I would like us to dwell on today. Person is gender neutral, by the way, in case you haven't noticed. God is so orderly. It was possible for Linnaeus to classify the plants, because God had created them through evolutionary methods in a very orderly way. But God was the first classifier. As we read, there is God, and below him are the angels, and a little below the angels is man, and below the species man are the animals and the other created forms and beings over which man has dominion. We're told quite a bit about the reproductive potential and mandate given to man. We're not incidentally told anything about reproduction in angels, as far as I know, but they are created beings. Man was told, fill the earth, multiply, administer nature and the earth on God's behalf. And this resonates very much with some of the parables of Jesus, in that there was a vineyard and people were put in charge of it by the owner, who was absent for a great deal of time. Now, there are various secular explanations to account for the presence of Homo sapiens on the earth. I don't want to spend a lot of time on these, but I would like to just briefly mention the one which is fairly dominant in my field of science at the moment. And then I'd like to move on to the biblical definition of Homo sapiens and what that involves. But a very common explanation at the moment by many of my scientific colleagues who are not people of faith is that, of course, Homo sapiens came out of Africa, out of a long line of Homo species, and at some stage descended from the trees and began to forage and hunt on the plains of Africa. This is probably true. But then, built onto that piece of information are a whole lot of assumptions, which I find quite difficult to accept. They don't fit with my experience of reality. The assumptions are that when he was on the plane, he developed the ability, a bipedal ability, and was able to run fast, and therefore began to hunt in groups rather than as individuals living in the trees. And hunting wild animals in groups led to group behavior, so that man was no longer aware just of himself and his own self-interests, but he was aware of the interests of the group. And there were different groups. And the groups were not always friendly to each other. And so therefore it was beneficial for man to develop an ethic which would enable him to look after the interests not only of himself but of his group. And out of this arose man's ethical conscience and knowledge and altruism. This, I think, in very brief terms, is the most common summary in my field at the moment. And I find it, I'm not going to explain now why, I find it inadequate, but it is totally inadequate. By contrast, the Bible gives us a revelation of why, how we came here, and why we are here. And the biblical revelation really matches our experience of reality. The Bible, from the beginning, is really concerned about people, persons, values, morality, ethics. And these are qualities of human beings that you and I know so well that we are able to think, express emotions, consider, give opinions, look back to the past, anticipate the future. This is one reason why I had us read Job 32, allegedly the oldest, the book that relates to the oldest period in the Bible. The expressions used in Job cannot possibly be attributed to any other living creature. As Job said, we can discuss, we can think, we can plan, we can view ourselves and we can view others and we can view God. We can disagree, we can recognize pride and humility and ambition. These are all very, very human characteristics. In a way, this uniqueness of man was well summed up by Immanuel Kant, the German philosopher, when he developed his view of man and said, we must not just use each other as other parts of the natural creation, because persons are unique. They resemble each other. They're not to be used as commodities, exploited, destroyed, ignored, which sadly, of course, our present Western culture tends to do. The dominant values in our Western cultures do see people as consumers or workers or investors. And Kant was saying, look, we must not use each other in that way. We must recognize the uniqueness of every individual person. And this theme was also taken up, I think, quite powerfully by Martin Buber, the German Jewish philosopher who fled Israel before Hitler could get him. But he wrote and spoke about the I-thou relationship. I am an individual, a person, unique, and you are too. And you and I must have an equality of recognition of each other and value each other, which he said is very different from the I-it relationship. It's the same thought as Immanuel Kant. We can look at the whole creation as we do, and we can take parts of it and turn it into objects for our own use, but we mustn't do that with other people. We must not have an I-it attitude to others. Now, of course, the scriptures do give us a mandate to be in charge of the whole creation, and in that sense, man in relation to the natural creation is in an I-it relationship, mandated to act as God's steward, to have dominion, but not domination. But human beings are separate and must be treated differently, and we must treat each other very differently. What are our characteristics as humans? Well, of course, we have the wonderful story, God's revelation to us, of the period in which man was created in the Garden of Eden. Now, the garden was a very special place. And if we go back to Genesis and look carefully at what happened in the garden, we find that God did some quite extraordinary things. It seems that he took Homo sapiens, made from the earth, made from the dust, a creature which was a wild animal, which had evolved over millions of years, and he said, let's make this one in our image. Why didn't he take a lizard and do it? He'd made all these other creatures. They'd gradually all been formed over millions and millions of years by the programming that God had put into the DNA and all the natural processes and molecules which make us physical. Why didn't he take a lion and say, let's make the lion in our image? Homo sapiens was but another animal living in the wild. No, he took Homo sapiens because by then, through the evolutionary process, our bodies had reached a stage where they were capable of functioning and serving some of the qualities which belong to God and which would be implanted in us. So we arrive at this very interesting situation that we have very advanced eyes as Homo sapiens. And as someone has said, we don't see with the eye, we see through the eye. I am inside. I have an eye which enables me to see through. And similarly, most of us have come to the point where we recognize that we have a brain through which our inner self, call it your spirit, your mind, your being, can express itself. And of course, Homo sapiens has got a very large brain. That's probably why God didn't choose to make lizards in his image, or even lions and tigers. This animal, Homo sapiens, had reached the stage where it would function well as a vehicle for conveying the person inside and making contact with the external world. Now, in the garden, we read, I'm not going to go through it in detail, obviously, but you are familiar with it, that remarkable things happened in the garden. In the garden, first of all, God, which was a special place, separate from the earth which he created, and we don't know where it was, except that it was in the Middle East, because we are told about the rivers which are associated with the garden. So we know that it's in the area where human civilization first began. We know it's in the area where animals and plants were first domesticated, which was in the Middle East, in the area of the Caucasus. So in that sense, we are told that it was taking place on Earth. It wasn't out in space. God didn't make a garden floating as a planet somewhere else. He located it right on Earth and said it's a geographic place. But of course, we can't find it. Why can't we find it? Because at the end of chapter 3, following the interaction between God and Adam and Eve, he put cherubim there to guard the way so that man would never be able to go back into the Garden of Eden. That's why we can't find it. We're precluded, excluded. But when it existed, remarkable things happened there. This animal, Homo sapiens, for which God had prepared a garden, having already created the animal, brought him in, and there God communed with man. We read that in the cool of the evening, God came into the garden, and on the occasion that is recorded, there was breakdown in the relationship, but we must assume that this was a practice, that communion was going on between God and the animal, Homo sapiens, in the garden. God came. Secondly, what happened in the garden, there was speech. Speech of very complex kind, not just the way in which animals are able to communicate with each other, but speech of such remarkably complex kind that we've read in Job and that we read in all of the scriptures. And then God explained that he was going to make man and woman for each other. And in fact, he ordained marriage in the garden. And not only that, he actually implemented a very practical program of food supply. Although the food supply had been created in the process of evolution, the garden itself was furnished with all sorts of good trees with various fruits on them. It's almost as though God had domesticated some of the species and put them in the garden. You could even follow that thought through and say it was really God's idea of putting domesticated plants and animals in the garden, which gave Adam and Eve the idea of domestication when they were expelled. Another thing that happened in the garden was that we encounter evil and good. And the two components of that are so interesting. One is knowledge of good and evil. We have knowledge of what is good and evil. But more than having knowledge, we also have moral autonomy. We can choose. Now, many of these characters are godlike characters. And it seems that when God said, let's make this animal, and they are animals, my body is constructed very much like the higher animals, But I have this dimension within me, identified by Immanuel Kant and Martin Buber and by the Bible, which says, you're like God. You have God-like quality. You are made in God's image. And then we find in the garden also the first indication of guilt for having disobeyed God, and shame. Shame between two people who should have absolute transparency, and shame between the man and the woman and their God. So they hid themselves and tried to cover themselves. Well, the deep meaning of all of these things are each subjects for many sermons and even for books. And I don't want to go through them, but I want to highlight them as events that, according to God's revelation in the scriptures, were part of the formation of man, separate from, but similar to, the higher animals, as part of the creation, but mandated to care for it. Incidentally, it always seems to me an interesting two statements that have some connection with each other. There is the expulsion from the garden, which God said prevented man and woman from going back and finding out about themselves to the extent that they are godlike. We can explore ourselves very easily in physical terms, but to go back and find ourselves, find out how we were formed in God's image, we are barred from that. It is a mystery. It is a mystery. It's a wonderful mystery because we experience it. But the other thought, which was also hidden, is when God said, I think pictorially, Adam, you're pretty lonely. I know that you need a companion like yourself. Have a look through the animal catalogue. And so he brought all the animals to Adam, and Adam named them, which is a symbol of power. And when he finished, he said, well, I'm happy to be a zookeeper, but I haven't found a mate. Anybody that is one with me, that I can identify with. And God then caused Adam to go into a deep sleep. We really don't understand the process of how men and women are different. We are different. It's hidden from us. We're asleep as far as that subject is concerned. Trying to find out and define not just the physical anatomy and physiology and estrogens and hormones, not that we can do, but to really find out what makes a man and a woman different from each other and partners to each other is still a mystery. Marriage is a mystery. And it's as though the Old Testament scriptures are saying to us, yeah, that is something that you're asleep on that subject. Now I need to finish because I hope we're going to have a good discussion. If we move forward in Genesis to chapter 4, we find a very interesting situation. God closed the gate of the Garden of Eden and thrust Adam and Eve out into the wilderness, the wilderness that had come about as a result of evolution, from which he had temporarily taken them out and put them in a special enclosure, which may have been physical or may have been conceptual. We don't know because the boom has been lowered and we can't go there. We know what happened there, but we don't know where and how and when it happened exactly. We may have a clue about when. We know that Homo sapiens came out of Africa and began to spread across the Middle East. And we know that the latest exodus, there were some early exoduses which came out because we of the Homo group, because we have discovered in recent years Homo floriensis, which are the hobbits, the people whose remains were discovered in the island of Indonesia, who resemble us in very, very strong ways, except that they're smaller. And then, of course, there were the Homo Davisonian, who were discovered in a cave in Siberia in the Altai Mountains. And then, of course, there was Homo Neanderthalensis, who preceded us. Well, all of those three that we have identified became extinct. But we know that Homo sapiens came very closely on the heels of Neanderthal man because we've got 4% of the genes that came from Neanderthals in humans. So this begins to put a little bit of time frame on Homo sapiens. And we know that Homo sapiens really began to behave as a human not before 60,000 BC. Now, between 60,000 and BC and 10,000 BC, something very remarkable happened. Because if you go back 60,000, when man first came out of Africa and began to move into the central Europe, the central Middle East, the Caucasus area, and then came into Europe, he began increasingly to do things that we identify as human. But he came out of the garden around 10,000 BC. How do I know? Because without any shadow of doubt, the domestication of cattle, sheep, and goats, and the domestication of wheat, and barley, and oats, and settled farming began about 10,000 BC. That's a fact. Go and talk to any anthropologist, archaeologist, scientist. It's one of the most well-established facts in human history. Now, if you read the beginning of chapter 4, you read very clearly that Adam, Cain, and Abel were settled farmers. Cain was growing crops because he tilled the soil. It says he tilled the soil, which means he sowed some soil, and then he brought from the crops an offering to God. And we know that Cain was a shepherd. Yeah. You don't shepherd wild sheep, you only shepherd domestic sheep. So we know that somewhere between 60,000 BC and 10,000 BC, the events that took place in the Garden of Eden must have occurred. And it's at that point that the Bible begins to link us, at that point, the beginning of chapter 4 of Genesis, the Bible begins to link us into known human history. Because it records that Cain and Abel behaved like farmers, and we know that soon, about five generations later, which may only be indicative of a large number of generations, mankind began using stringed instruments and wind instruments. They're mentioned specifically in chapter 4, as though giving us a point where we can jump into human history, which is known. What we know when those instruments were first used, after 10,000 BC. And then it tells us that they began to use metalwork, particularly bronze and then iron. And that takes us right down to about 2,500 BC. The flood can be pretty well identified now from various means, which I won't go into, at about 5,600 BC. So, I'd like to leave these thoughts with you. I've used my time. And we can discuss further, I hope you will, what it means to be human, maybe how man became human, and maybe a discussion on some of the other things that characterize us and which seem to have taken place in that mysterious period known as the Garden of Eden.